Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by Ben Cahill. Hey man, it's been a while since we last spoke on this show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, since we last spoke, you have left iRobot, hopefully not connected to the acquisition by AWS or Amazon. You've been, I guess, taking time off, and I can see that you've been also writing some stuff. And before we get into that, maybe can you just give the audience, tell audience who you are and what's your experience and journey with serverless?
Yeah. So I'm Ben Kehoe. I'm an AWS serverless hero, and most recently I was a cloud robotics research scientist at iRobot. And at iRobot, I joined in 2015 after getting a PhD in cloud robotics. And at iRobot, that was when we were launching the first connected Roomba. And as part of that, after launch, we switched from a full solution IoT cloud provider to a system that we owned more of. And as part of doing that, we decided to go entirely serverless with it so that we didn't have to learn how to scale cloud systems to Roomba volumes. So that was AWS IoT Core and Lambda and API Gateway and DynamoDB. And at least when I left, there were no VMs or containers in production, and I suspect that that is still the case. And so that really enabled the company to focus on delivering features rather than spending time on the solving technical problems for how do you make this system scale and be responsive and all of those things.
Yeah, and you guys were one of the earliest, I guess, adopters of Lambda and serverless at really big scale. And I remember you talking about around Christmas time how about 4 million robots just turned online around the same time. And for you, it's pretty much a business as usual, apart from the occasional upscaling of your Elasticsearch cluster, which at the time, I think you mentioned was probably the only kind of server for components in your architecture that requires babysitting. Otherwise, a couple million robots coming online around the same time, it's just fine. System just scales on its own.
Yeah, I mean, all those robots that are sold between Black Friday and Christmas get opened in most of them in a 4-hour window on Christmas morning. So they come on, people unwrap them and they connect them to the cloud. And it really is a non-event. It's not something that operationally is a big deal. Every year after when we started, there's always something that we hadn't fully planned for. DynamoDB wasn't the provision throughput on it wasn't correct, or the Kinesis stream finally needed another shard at that point, or whatever it was. Then finally in 2021, we managed to get everything nailed down, and Christmas Day 2021 was completely hands-off keyboard. So that giant influx of robots everything operationally was handled by the services that we use. So that was, sort of that's the dream in serverless, is that you've built the system and I say it runs itself, but it's down to the fine folks at AWS, making sure that those services are scaled appropriately and taking those operations out of the hands of AWS customers like iRobot.
Yeah, that's what Werner just coins the heavy lifting, right? It's that kind of thing that we shouldn't have to worry about as users of Lambda. And I guess around that, you also you wrote some of the very early, I guess, articles around how to be thinking about specifically be thinking about serverless and how do we define the term serverless. And I remember very early on reading your blog post about how serverless is about a mindset. It's a spectrum. It's not just whether or not it's serverless or not, but different services land on different parts of that spectrum. And recently I had a discussion with Kirk Cornell from Memento, and they wrote a really interesting blog post about the litmus test of serverless, because we're seeing a lot of services being branded as serverless, even though they are still very much being built on a server, serverful basis. You know, some of the services AWS released, I think it was OpenSearch serverless or something like that, where you're looking at the minimum charge of $700 a month.
Yeah, it's quite a lot.
Which doesn't really quite gel with the concept of serverless. No, at least not for the people like us who's been used to this pay-per-use pricing model. But around the same time, you also wrote another piece about the meaninglessness of serverless, where you kind of argue that, you know, that the term serverless is being used to mean a lot of different things, and that's actually a good thing. And eventually, the term is going to go away, similar to how NoSQL was initially used to brand a whole bunch of different technologies under one umbrella marketing term, but eventually people just kind of moved away from this whole NoSQL marketing term.
I wouldn't say it's good that, you know, serverless as a term has become meaningless, but it's acceptable and inevitable. So it's not that I'm like, yes, it should lose meaning, but I think we don't have to fight it as hard as I think people tend to want to.
So is that because the fact that more and more things becoming labeled as serverless means we are progressing as a community and as an industry to see serverless more as something that, you know, should be part of more and more offerings and different services, would offer some element of serverless in terms of, you know, not having to manage and configure servers clusters and all of that, rather than, okay, everything can be branded as serverless so long there's some auto scaling.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's been a conversation about what does serverless mean since the early days. That first serverless is a spectrum article, I think I wrote in 2017, which that was in response to the conversation that had been going on. You know, so it was already back then people were arguing, oh, this is or isn't serverless. And I think that's, you know, never a good framing, because it's very rare in life, I think, that there are very clear, well-delineated categories where you can say something is or isn't, and it's better to talk about, you know, well, okay, this is in the blurry middle ground or something. You know, Lambda is pretty clearly on one end, and EC2 bare metal is very clearly at the other end, or, you know, a server from Dell. And then in the middle, you've got things that are all sort of a little bit mishmash, because clearly something like Fargate is closer to Lambda than EC2 bare metal. And so we need a way to talk about that. And if we can only say things are or aren't serverless, then that conversation becomes difficult. If you can say that Fargate is more serverless than EC2 bare metal, but less serverless than Lambda, that's a more productive conversation to have. So that's where that spectrum thing came along. I think the meaninglessness for me, and the article that I wrote on serverless as a mindset, is a similar sort of thing, where any term that is useful, any term that refers to something useful, marketing folks, because it is their job to do this, will look at that and say, that is a valuable thing to be associated with. And so I want to associate my product with it. And so they will find ways of labeling their product to associate it with that concept, regardless of whether it falls very cleanly into that concept or not. Good analogies for this are cloud and DevOps, right? Cloud computing was a useful thing that came along and said, okay, great. You know, you can rent out compute hours and services and these kind of things. And that was useful. People started using it and said, wow, this is really powerful. And so then people said, well, okay, our thing isn't quite that, but it's got aspects of it. So we're gonna slap the cloud label on this thing. And that's how you get private cloud and you get all these things. And eventually the term cloud is sort of meaningless, right? You still see debates over like, oh, that isn't actually cloud computing or whatever it is. But everyone's kind of okay with it because people understand what the benefits are and whether a thing has benefits rather than whether it's labeled cloud or not. So people understand like, oh, private cloud is, less useful in the ways that cloud is useful than public cloud. Now it's got other aspects that people may find attractive or whatever, and they may go for that. But saying something is or isn't, cloud is not something that we get too worked up about. We understand that it's fairly meaningless and mostly a marketing term. That's fine. Same with DevOps. DevOps, referred to a useful thing, and because it referred to a useful thing, everything wanted to be called DevOps or Agile or, is another one of these things. And so it starts to get applied to a broader range of use cases. And I think that is always inevitable with any term that refers to a useful concept. And so you can't stop that. So it's not useful or productive to try and police the usage of the term, and rather to work with an understanding that that is going to happen and focus on ways to help people understand what is useful and what is not, which is where we start talking about those functional aspects where it's not that these aspects of like a litmus test for serverless are not useful concepts. It's that we should be talking about those individual bullet points as functional characteristics of a system that it may or may not have, and if it has them, that's good.
Yep, that makes sense. And also, I guess you kind of reminds me of that famous quote for statistics that all models are wrong, but some are at least useful. It's funny also as well that you mentioned the DevOps and the Agile, and both terms has been so misused at this point. And again, like I said, it's probably just inevitable that now we have a company that are calling pretty much everyone DevOps, even though what they do has nothing to do with what we consider as DevOps, or shortening the amount of time between you checking and committing your code to it running safely in production, or the fact
Which
that.
is exactly the sort of thing we should talk about, right? Instead of saying, oh, are you doing DevOps or not? It's asking that question, how long is it between commit and production, right? When the term ceases to be useful for identifying a characteristic like that, we have to move towards actually identifying those characteristics individually and talking about them specifically.
Right. Okay. So you see the term itself as a delivery, I guess, the initial delivery mechanism of a group of new concepts. And then as the new concepts are better absorbed and understood by the wider community, we can start to put less focus on the term itself, but on the actual concepts that the term was supposed to encapsulate. Is that the way, is that what you're kind of thinking?
Yeah, I think that's the only way forward, I guess, is that once the term can't identify the substance that you want, you have to focus on those characteristics and you can invent new terms, right? Event-driven architecture is something that people use for certain aspects of serverless. It doesn't cover billing models, for example, but it does cover things that are useful. And then you can say, oh, this is event-driven architecture, and use that to identify. Now, if that becomes very useful, eventually that will get co-opted and become meaningless as well. And so you're always, fighting that battle or striving to overcome that inevitable process. So yeah, I think it's always, how can we communicate these concepts as well as possible. And for me, with the serverless mindset, the whole point has never been the actual technology itself, but rather that it enables focus on business problems rather than technology problems. And so all of these things, like, oh, I'm billed for exactly my usage, means that I have to work less on resource utilization and that there aren't servers exposed in the model, and therefore I don't have to maintain them, I don't have to worry about them. That enables focus, right? And so, in those ways, we can still talk about what is the goal of what we are trying to do here with any of these things, right? Cloud and serverless, I think, are well aligned on that front. What was the purpose of cloud in the first place? To remove technology problems from businesses so that they could focus better on things. Things like Agile and DevOps are a little more focused on how do you align people for more efficient, more effective delivery of products and things like that. And so, in a conversation about some process that's called Agile and some other process that's called Agile that aren't at all the same, you can ask, okay, which one of these is more effective at helping, especially a particular organization with the culture that that organization brings, delivering that more effectively. So I think always talking sort of about the functional aspects rather than the labels is critical even before that meaningless stage, but it becomes ever more important as the label itself ceases to be a good identifier for the things that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that applies to Agile in so many ways that
Oh, yeah.
so much so that the original people behind the Agile manifesto has been actively trying to move away from the Agile term itself or their role in defining the term because it becomes so toxic nowadays because everything else has sort of come and become labeled as Agiles. And I also remember, I guess, back in the day, the whole SOA, service-oriented architecture, just
Sure.
got took over by vendors. Everything became SOA at one point, and just lost complete meaning, or it meant the thing that is supposed to not be. And then now we got other things that we kind of think about, which are really the spiritual the spiritual successors of SOA, things like event-driven architectures, messaging-based systems. A lot of those are all coming from the SOA world, at least the original version of it, of smart endpoints, dumb pipes. All of these things became the thing that you used to identify what is a good design system, rather than the SOA itself, which was completely hijacked by marketing and the vendors.
Which again, I think is inevitable and not something that you can stop. Again, because it is a useful term and to be associated with it is good when a term is useful. And so people are going to do that. That's just going to happen. And I think we get too worked up about it, rather than finding ways in which that can happen, but we're still able to productively talk about the concepts. Or talk about them in ways that are more resistant to that, right? When you talk about functional aspects, when you say, it's harder to co-opt, request-based pricing as a term because it refers to something very specifically. Now, it's not a easy buzzword, which is why, the things that make good buzzwords are the things that get co-opted because they make good buzzwords. They're a useful shorthand for something. And so you have to go sort of the more wordy route of saying, here's more precisely what I mean. And at the same time, that doesn't sell as well for exactly the reason that makes the other thing co-optable, which is that it sells well.
I guess in terms of sort of selling things, so another thing that you've been, and also functional characteristics of things, another topic that you have been making a lot of noise about, which I don't think gets enough attention from AWS or the community as a whole, is the fact that we have a lot of developer experience issues with our tooling, and instead of actually fixing them at the source, with say CloudFormation, we are seeing a lot of attempts at fixing them at the client end with tooling such as CDK, such as what they're trying to do now with SAM, which is commendable. But really, what we needed was some fixes around the CloudFormation side of things. And this is something that comes in, I guess, waves. Now we're seeing, for a while we saw, SAM was being a bit dormant. It feels like a lot of the momentum was with CDK, but suddenly in the last couple of months, I'm seeing a lot more focus now being put back onto SAM, and they're pushing a lot of new features in, which is great. But again, you're looking at things that's going to benefit one segment of user base that uses SAM, versus fixing the root cause at the CloudFormation level. That's going to benefit pretty much all the people that are using AWS and a lot of these tools that build on top of CloudFormation as well. Do you have some specific examples of things that you think, okay, that's something that you're now trying to fix with SAM or CDK that really should be improved at CloudFormation instead?
Yeah, well, I think, in CloudFormation itself is doing this a little bit with the language extensions transform, which is saying instead of implementing features in the core language engine, it's going to be implemented in a macro that processes it before the core engine, runs the actual template. And that's enabled them to move faster, but it's, worse than having that just be CloudFormation work that way. And so there's a trade-off there. Yes, we've gotten those features. That's good. The thing that gets me most is when developers aren't looking at the total cost of ownership of these things. These client-side answers have an increased cost of ownership because the ownership, instead of lying with a fully managed service, lies with the customer who's using the client-side tooling provided by the vendor, AWS or whoever else. And the developers often don't see the operational costs or the increased ownership that they're taking on when they do that. They see the developer experience that they get at author time, and they say, "Oh, this is great. It's, fancy. It can do all these things for me." But then when it breaks and they're on the hook for figuring out how to fix it, or, it doesn't have to be backwards compatible because, again, it not being a managed service means you can just say, well, that version isn't supported anymore, and the deprecation isn't viewed as negatively. What I really want to see is developers looking at that total cost of ownership piece and saying, when a vendor hands me a client-side answer, I'm going to push back and say, well, okay, this is great for now, but I want to see more of this moved service side so that I don't have to own the operations or maintenance for this thing. Right? The thinner that client-side piece is, the more of that burden is being taken on by the vendor. And that's what we want in serverless. That's, a important facet of the serverless mindset of, how we've talked about serverless for a long time in, the details, which is it's a provider taking on more of the burden of the entire life cycle of the software creation process. And so when devs really just focus on the author time experience, they miss out on getting more of their runtime and maintenance and all of these other burdens taken off them by that provider. And so then it doesn't happen as much. Those companies only focus on the author time experience, and they don't focus on how can we actually take more of this burden off of those developers. And so we need developers to be understanding that end-to-end cost that they have, and therefore be demanding that companies spend more time on those pieces.
I'm so grateful that you bring this point up about the separation of the author time experience versus the operational time experience. Because one of the things that's been sort of popping up quite more and more now is this infrastructure from code, which I think is at least not, I guess I don't want to lump all the different attempts at solving this problem into the same category. And I'd love to get Jeremy Daly to come and talk about AMP and what they're doing there. But whenever I'm seeing some of the solutions out there that says, oh yeah, we're just going to generate your cloud infrastructure based on the code you have. But when I look into how they actually do it, all of that is author time solution. But at the operational time when something breaks, you still have to understand what were the functions that was created, where are the logs, where can I find the logs, and if something breaks, how did I end up with this problem in the first place? And I have to at that point essentially do the reverse engineering, understanding how my code transformed into this piece in my infrastructure. And so you've got this not only the fact that not only sort of kind of missing that link, unless you really understand what the tool is doing, in which case, well, why do I need the tool in the first place? Maybe I can use ChatGPT to help me save some typing if that's the problem that I'm trying to solve, that less typing. So what are your, I guess, what's your take on some of this infrastructure from code solutions? Because on the one hand, I think it's great that it's pushing us towards the sort of serverless stream of only worry about business logic. But on the other hand, if that just means a client-side solution, then we are just creating a problem that people won't realize until something breaks for the first time.
There's another blog post I have to write, or that I've got, a draft of, that I should maybe come back and talk about this again once I do that, because I think infrastructure from code is wrong on all counts. I don't think we should call it infrastructure. I don't think it's right to use the term code to refer to what it is referring to in that term. And I don't think creating what we shouldn't call infrastructure from what we shouldn't call code is the right approach. So in particular, I think the idea of, oh, just write business logic, right, is good. But as you say, if what a product does is generate a bunch of stuff that then the customer owns, that dev now is accountable for, that's the opposite of what we want it to do, which is, here, I've just provided this code, and maybe, sure, you infer, you know, something about it. But if the vendor is inferring that, they should actually operationalize that entire piece. And then they've actually taken that burden off of the customer, right? Whereas today, what they're doing is taking it off of the developer, but leaving it on the developer's business. And so, and I don't think that that's good, because developers then think that they're lowering the amount of ownership that they have because they're not writing it. But either they or someone else at that company is still going to have to run it. I also think that when we talk about business logic, we miss that business logic exists in things that are not general purpose programming languages. The choice to have an SQSQ in your architecture is a business logic decision. It is saying that I need persistence for this message that is passing through. If I don't need persistence, if that's not a requirement for what I am attempting to do in my product, then I can just have an SNSQ or topic, right? And if that message is dropped, that's fine. I don't need to worry about it, right? Similarly, you know, I like to say that least privilege policies are business logic, because the choice of what matters and doesn't matter in an authorization decision is specific to the business case that you're doing, right? To say, oh, these attributes matter, so I'm going to put tag conditions in here, or they don't matter, or whatever it is that you do to make that policy exactly suited to your situation is situated to your situation, which is the definition of business logic, right? The irreducible complexity that's specific to your, to the problem that you're solving. So I think the infrastructure from code thing is focused on developers typing. And I don't think that developers typing is the real bottleneck for TCO. I think we also don't want those general purpose programming, you know, hunks of code to be how we primarily think about these systems that we're creating. That you're creating a distributed system to solve a business problem. And if you have to sprinkle custom code in there, you want to minimize that as much as possible. I want to string together managed services in such a way that there isn't any custom code in there that you could use to infer what I'm doing. If I can accomplish this entirely through a step function state machine that uses integrations purely and doesn't need any Lambda tasks in it, what code would you infer that from? I don't have any in there. And that leaves me better off. And so this code-centric thinking of, oh yeah, I actually just want to be typing and the rest of it is all infrastructure, is I think the wrong way to think about it.
Have you played around with Node-RED, this project from IBM from, I don't know how many years ago?
I remember it. I didn't look at it too closely, but it's, I remember it being interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I forgot the name of the service. It became on the IBM OpenWhisk platform. But essentially, you have, say, like a visual designer where you can say, hey, here's a bit of a sort of transformation that, or say, text to a speech to text box. And then here's, you connect that to another box, let's say, doing translation. And then you connect that to another box that goes a text to speech. So all of a sudden, you've got this business logic that can take some input as speech, MP3 or whatever files, transcribe that, and then translate the transcription text file, and then turn it back into speech, and you can then ship it off as generate some kind of executable, which was really interesting. At the time, it was quite ahead of its time. This was must be. Oh God! I mean,
it sounds
7 years
a bit like
ago.
Step Functions Visual Designer.
Yeah, yeah, right. But ahead of time, and also lets you operate at a higher level of abstraction compared to Step Functions, which is still much lower level in terms of the actual orchestration of individual pieces, as opposed to fully
It's not
managed.
the high-level
Yeah,
tasks.
exactly. It's not a high-level task. You can just say, here's what I want you to do. And it's not the same as, say, Stackery or the new Application Composer, which again is about piecing together infrastructure as opposed to business capabilities, which was something that I thought was really interesting, but for some reason just never took off. Maybe just too far ahead of its time. And I've also spoken with other founders. I think Tempral was one example where the founder was very adamant that well, developers just want to look at code, even though step functions, I actually want to have something that's more visual that gives me the ability to switch to code if I need to change things and all that, because I think visual representation is great, but because of all of these things that are still so verbose in terms of configuration, oftentimes you still need to be able to represent a lot of the details and to be able to change them with code. Whereas their thinking was completely okay, yeah, visual is just not what developers want. They just want to look at code all day.
I think it's correct that developers want to. I don't know that it's correct that that's good. And so I think there's a bit of, there's always tension between meeting people where they are and leading them where you want them to go. And so I get the feeling that, oh, coding is fun. It feels productive, right? You get in a flow state, you do all this stuff, and it feels really good. That doesn't mean it's productive. That doesn't mean it's the most effective way to accomplish the task you've been given, but it feels good and people gravitate towards it for that reason. And so I think a lot of what I push for is for developers to think differently about that and understand, I get more frustrated when I'm wrestling with step functions, but I come away with something that has a lower total cost of ownership, and that has more benefit than if I spent that time coding up something that was more fun to make, but has a high total cost of ownership, which means I'll be coming back to it to fix it, to maintain it, to do all these things. And so, a real thing that I wrestle with and I don't have a good answer for is how do you convince developers to shift in thinking from, I define myself around, typing, around coding in this very specific narrow definition. And anything that leads me away from that feels like I am not doing the thing that I'm supposed to be doing or that I want to be doing, into this broader understanding of being a developer as being a problem solver, as pulling together disparate components in ways that solve those problems better and easier often, but don't necessarily conform as well to the identity that we've built for ourselves as developers.
Yeah, it's difficult to separate your purpose versus from the things you do to achieve that purpose. Every time I bring up the point that the employers don't pay us to write code, to produce code,
Yes.
rather than to produce outcomes, positive outcomes for the business. Every time I bring that up, someone will always remind me, "Oh yeah, that's just wishful thinking."
I hope it's not wishful thinking. I hope we can make some progress on it.
Yeah, and also I think that the point you made earlier about there's a difference between what you want versus what's actually good for you reminds me of the talk you did way back when the CDK was just getting all the hype about oh yeah the whole using general purpose language. The point you made about okay, that's like taking kids to a candy store. Of course, they're just gonna grab everything they want, but it doesn't mean that it's actually good for them.
Well, and like kids, when developers have, a too high operational burden or incidents that they have difficulty solving because it's with resources that they are not familiar with because it was abstracted away from them, and you say, well, this is because you ate all this candy, and the kid says, no, it wasn't, and refused to accept that. And so I'm big on eating your vegetables. And I know that that's not a popular position among developers or toddlers. But I think it's important to, at the very least, push for those things and try and get a balance in there.
Yeah, I think you and I are going to get a lot of heat from just calling developers toddlers, but I think you actually got a point there.
If we want to go controversial, I think a lot of the conversation that we have around developers does very much talk about them as if they were toddlers. That we say, oh, this wasn't the intention of the phrase or, argued for, from Redmonk, the developers of the new Kingmakers, a result of that conversation is this perception that developers are somehow specially privileged within an organization that need to be not asked to do things that make them bored, as if other people in the organization exist only to support developers and not, you know, don't have importance in their own right. You know, we especially see this in sort of the toxic thread that's existed for a very long time in our industry around, you know, operations folks, you know, a perception that they're not real programmers, that, oh, you know, bash scripting isn't real programming, that defining infrastructure in YAML isn't real programming, all of those things, which are all incorrect. That when we say, oh, developers need to be given something, you know, oh, if you don't make security easy enough, developers just won't do it. And there's a difference between understanding that introducing friction into a process can lead people to avoid it and saying that people are right to avoid it if there's friction in it, right? Security is everyone's responsibility, and developers have that responsibility. We're all flawed humans. When we're under time pressure, we take the easy way out. And that's a thing that we can understand without saying that we are right to be doing so. And so I do think that the way we talk about developers and the way that we as an industry talk about the position that they have within organizations is something that other positions within the organization don't get. And I don't think that that's good.
Yeah, and totally. And also, I guess a lot of developers who are under the age of maybe 30 something probably just don't remember the time when your job, you were part of a cost center. You were not the center of the world. You were there to do all the hard work so that some other department can make more money. I mean, that is the world that I started my programming career in. You know, it was never about catering to my needs. I have to do the hard graph so that someone else can click a button and some magic happens on the UI. So I think we've come a long way towards a more sort of a tech, developer-friendly environment, which I think is great, but also at the same time feels like sometimes we feel, you know, we're a bit too much on the other end, the other extreme, where we're kind of pampering to some of the worst inclinations of developers and encouraging them, as opposed to striking a better balance between, okay, you know, what if it's difficult? It's your job. Just get on with it.
Yeah, sometimes, right? And understanding, oh, it's difficult. You still have to want, like, you have to accept that you should be doing it, even when you can understand, oh, I'm going to take this shortcut because I'm being asked to do this week in this sprint, and I'm not going to be able to do it if I do all the things that I'm supposed to be doing. But asking for, oh yeah, help me be better at this. Help me be my best self. Rather than saying, oh, I don't, you know, I have no obligation to do the hard things if I find them hard and I don't think that they are worthwhile, right? Being more of a mutually supportive network within an organization.
Absolutely. And talking about being mutually supportive, I want to just kind of pivot a little bit our conversation towards AI, because everyone's losing their minds about AI for good and for bad. And the one topic which I guess don't get talked about enough in the context of large language models, but well, maybe they are being talked about in terms of the image generators like Midjourney, which is under a class action lawsuit right now. But one of the things that kind of worries me in terms of the future development of AI or making better large language models, apart from the whole Skynet scenario, is the fact that, what we have right now is really powerful chatbots that's been trained on really good quality data that's been accumulated over many years by many content creators who's been there to share their ideas. And I think we've lived through this golden age of social media where someone's got a great idea, they get discovered, and they can make a living out of keep producing quality content and contribute towards that discourse.
And I wouldn't call what we've been in a golden age of social media, but okay. I get what you're saying, that it's possible for content creators to get seen and have control over what is seen.
Yeah, and that they get rewarded for putting good ideas forward and for sharing real important insights. And because large language models, they don't actually experience anything, and we're seeing a lot of implications of that in terms of, a lot of these models generating, hallucinating answers that looks almost right. And unless you know exactly what you're looking for, you can probably fool a lot of people that are just trying to get something done. And you know, they're going to take the answers from ChatGPT, put it into their solution, thinking this looks right, and not realizing there's some really subtle mistakes in there that a ChatGPT is not able to identify for itself. But also, more importantly, because it doesn't actually experience anything, it has no real human insights to offer. And if we don't have a way to maybe, you know, have some kind of a attribution so that you know, great content creators sharing useful insights are getting some of that value back. And if chat does replace search as we know it, then all of the revenue, all of the discoverability that we've had with social media, is going to disappear. And I worry about the incentives for content creators to keep sharing if their voice is going to go to nothing apart from the training data for the next chat version of a ChatGPT. Is this something that you think is this a potential path that we're going down? And do you think there's anything that we are doing, or the big companies are doing to kind of address this kind of problem to create incentives for quality data to be continued to be created so that they can train the next GPT or whatever chatbot that is going to be able to offer experience or answers for new things that's going to be created that no one's going to be right about because, well, why should I write it if no one's going to read it anyway?
Yeah, I don't have hopeful input to provide on this. You know, I tweeted quite a while ago now about, you know, when Midjourney and such, you know, sort of before ChatGPT and such, where the focus was really on image creation, and the conversation was around art and artists and all of that. That, I mean, I imagine someone must have written this sci-fi story because I can't, you know, I don't. It seems like a relatively obvious one to create. That at some point, the inexpensiveness that it's nearly free to get an image from AI, and so no one is paying for art anymore. They're only getting it from AI, and it becomes unsustainable for artists to continue creating and to have a creative market for this. Humanity stops creating art, and all of the art that's created is interpolated from the closed set that we have. That's a dystopian sci-fi story. I think there's a danger of something like that, both on the art front and on the broader content front, where, you know, if chat replaces search and chat is summarizing possibly inaccurately the content that you're creating, you no longer have sort of editorial control over what you're putting out. All of it is filtered through this AI lens for the people who are reading it. Maybe there's attributions, maybe there's not, but we've already seen that this is a problem in Google search, that Google trying to do something which consumers like, which its end users like, which is I don't actually have to click through to the website. Google is presenting a summary of things when I ask for, you know, some celebrity age or, you know, whatever it is. And because Google can know those things, and then there's nothing to click through. That's already a problem because it reduces those click-through rates. It makes those sites less sustainable to provide that information, all of these things. That's going to get worse with chat as chat gets better at summarizing those things. I think, you know, on the tech industry front, there's a lot of interest in what if I write docs so that they're consumed by ChatGPT? I think there is a danger there in, it's not lowest common denominator, but I don't think LLMs are ever going to be the best doc writers. Now, maybe that brings up the average, you know, that raises the floor of companies that today have poorly documented APIs and such, and LLMs enable them to have better documentation, and that's better for their community. At the same time, if it means that companies that are really investing in their docs instead say we're going to go the easy route because it's so much cheaper and good enough that we get this middling level of documentation out, that sure, we're better off in some ways, but we're missing out on important things that push the state of the art forward, which is, you know, again, that sort of real danger that I think that says, okay, great, we get into this space where LLMs are providing us so much of the content that we see, and LLMs are not pushing the boundaries of what's possible in terms of the content itself. They're going to say, how do I stay within the bounds that people expect based on my training set? So they're going to say, this is the most plausible thing. And in all these situations, especially in art, but also within other types of content, you want people saying, this is outside the bounds of what's currently the conversation. And that's how we push the conversation forward.
That's a great point. That's something that I remember listening to Scott Galloway and his Prof G podcast. And he also mentioned this point about how chatbots is not about raising the quality of the output, but it's about lowering the cost of generating a minimum level of output. That's why companies like BuzzFeed just fired a bunch of writers and have the existing writers work with a chat instead of actually getting better output. They don't care. They're just spitting out SEO pieces, which doesn't really add to the discord or improve, or like you said, the pushing the boundary of the art of writing things. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And like you said, if artists are no longer incentivized to create new ideas and new art, at some point we're just going to end up with the style that we have today. There's not going to be any new styles. And I guess the same goes to the content creators, the ones that are still presenting good ideas and pushing the conversation forward might still be generating those high quality content that you won't find from chat. But how many of them get the practice they need to get to that point to be able to create content that is of significantly better quality if they never get discovered in the first place, if they never had the chance to practice their craft and get better at writing documentations, if everything else just, okay, this is good enough, and that's what everyone settles for.
And I think, you know, one way that I put it in the art sense is that, like, an AI, as they currently exist, that's trained on modernist art will never invent postmodernism, right? That let me make something that's in contrast, you know, that specifically interacts and reacts to the existing state of the art is not something that these models are designed to do. It's a hard thing. It's, you know, and as eventually, I don't think we are close to it, but as eventually we move towards AGI and things and potentially different AR architectures, you know, et cetera, we may be able to see more of that. But without it, I think in our industry, when we have these things that enable us to move further forward, to say serverless as an example, right, or agile when it was happening, that challenged the received wisdom. The way that those form is by people, you know, as you mentioned on social media, finding an audience and being able to connect and build those things. And if AI has a flattening effect where people don't know the questions to ask that will lead them to be able to build these communities around these new ideas and things where that AI is giving the answer, oh, how should I build my application? And it never says, oh, hey, here's a way to do it without a server when everybody's building with servers. That's going to, again, impede our growth. Now, you know, I think people who are optimistic about AI will say, oh, you just need to ask it about how could I do this without a server. But I think that's the trick, is how to know to ask that question and whether AI will help us ask those questions. Like, will it make it more likely or less likely that we're asking those questions?
Yeah, I remember reading this, what was this, a psychology or some experiment, and they found that unless you have the right vocabulary, you're not capable of having the thoughts. So they went to some remote village, I think in the South Americans, and realized and found that the tribe that didn't have the language or the word for a number, they just couldn't grasp at the concept of this number, like number four, because they don't have it, or they don't have the word for a color, so they can't see the difference between, I don't know, different shades of blue. Or some other tribes have got that four different words for blue, so they can distinguish the really subtle differences in the color of blue that we can't tell the difference. So now, having that the language, I think going back to, you know, the wording serverless, without having that new word that brings a new meaning, a new way of thinking, we just never would have the ability to ask those questions in the first place. That's going to help us move the conversation and move the, I guess, collective understanding and the thinking forward.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, In general, that's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And it's my understanding of it is that in general, the evidence is sort of the flip of that. Instead of it being that your vocabulary or your language dictates what you can think about, it dictates what you have to think about, right? So if you do have different words for many colors, you have to pick among those many colors. Whereas languages that have fewer words for color, it's not that they have fewer colors, it's that they tend to express it in modifications of colors. So instead of it being, there are languages that have different words for blue and light blue. And in English, we just say blue and light blue, and we think of them both as blue. We think of them as the same color. And in these other languages that distinguish between blue and light blue, you have to decide which of those two colors it is, because they're not both the same color. So and I think if we, again, move that to how are we going to interact with these AIs, again, the more that it's flattening it, the more that we're using a less rich vocabulary or that the things that we're obligated to talk to it about, if it's connecting to us in a way that makes it easier and challenges us less, the more we're going to fall into those patterns where we're not able to move forward because we're thinking purely in the manner that we have always done, and we're not asked to think about different things. Now, again, I think the AI optimist will say AI will help us do those things, but I am skeptical of that. It'd be nice if it did, but I'm not, particularly bullish on that front.
Okay, so I guess switching back to serverless, last question, Ben. What do you think are the biggest problem with serverless right now?
I think the biggest problem is that we've drifted away from a focus on business value, on solving business problems, understanding total cost of ownership, into a more narrowly developer perspective and a more narrowly general purpose code specific perspective. That we've moved away from the sort of serviceful understanding of serverless, where what we want to do is use more managed services and plug them together in more managed ways, back to the old ways of I just want to write code in ways that satisfies my identity as a developer. And the total cost of ownership is not a primary concern or primary goal as part of my perspective on that. I do want it to be easier, and where easier aligns with lower TCO, that's great. But as a developer, that's not, how I'm thinking about it. So I want us to move back away from what I consider to sort of be more traditional thinking in that realm about, that coding is productivity inherently, those kind of things, and back more into this place of that's more uncomfortable, where we have to challenge ourselves more and ask more about how we fit into the bigger total cost of ownership for the business and fit in more with the cost of ownership for other teams. How do I balance? Okay, I'm a developer and there's a separate ops team. How do I reduce total cost of ownership for both of us and not just, oh, this is easier for me, but increases the burden on the ops team? That's not a good option that the developers should want to choose. So I think that's the challenge that I'm seeing and that I want to push for in the serverless space.
Yeah, totally agree. And almost like the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, I think a big factor there is competing with Kubernetes that in the early days of serverless was before Kubernetes was big, and we were in competition with a less mature containerized space, and we said, hey, great, here's all of these benefits that you get, but you have to build differently. And that was marketable at that point. And then Kubernetes came along and said, well, we solve a lot of these problems with containerization and traditional architectures, and we don't ask you to think differently. And that's very attractive because you don't have to, that's much more comfortable space to go to is, oh, this isn't making me uncomfortable having to build differently. I can feel like it's the things that I'm used to. And when you're competing against that, you have to move further back along that spectrum to say, great, I know you're comfortable with Kubernetes and these things. Here's a way that you can stay comfortable but get some serverless benefits. Like all of these things, infrastructure from code, they're still providing some serverless benefits in there. They're not as much as we should be getting And that's why I want to push it further forward than that. But I think those have been brought about or are more successful now because we're competing against a much more attractive traditional architecture. And so the important point is not that it's not good to try and bring more of those developers a little further in the serverless direction, but that we shouldn't be pitching that as the end goal of like, oh, this is what serverless should be. It's, oh, this is a waypoint on that serverless journey. Okay, now you want to start reducing the amount of code that you're writing and be dealing more only with architecture and resources. That's further in the serverless direction. And we're losing part of that conversation.
Right, right. Gotcha. Yeah, because I guess if you just go into that midway point and call it done, then that you never really go through the entire mindset change, and you never think about, you never change your mindset about what's productivity. You're still thinking yeah. about coding is productivity. It's not about, you're not really thinking about a business. You're thinking about yourself as a coder, as an engineer, and thinking about your identity rather than what you do, rather than what value you're bringing to the business.
Yes, you are not your tools.
Exactly.
And all of your expertise and skills that you've built up using these tools is going to be applicable to new realms. And the people, you know, they say, oh, well, I do this. I'm this kind of developer. I, you know, use these tools. And it's like, you're so much more than that. And you've got so much expertise that you've built up from those tools that allows you to see problems in new ways and useful ways that when applied with new tools that allow you to create more value more quickly with lower TCO, those are going to be valuable. You just have to give up that those tools are who you are as a developer.
Thank you, Ben. That's as usual, that's very insightful. And the stuff that you just mentioned there, those are the things that I kind of almost feel like every developer should learn to be like a consultant, because the kind of value question is at the very core of every, I guess, conversation you have with client. It's never about how much line of code I can help you write. It's about how much value I can bring to your business, not even yourself or your developers. It's about your business value and my value to you, and how much I can hope to, you know, convince you to pay me. It's very much tied to that, the value proposition. But yeah, it's always great to talk to you, and I look forward to keep in touch and hear what your next steps are. Very intrigued. I'm sure loads of other people in the community is also waiting to hear about your next steps and see what you're going to do next. And I'm looking forward to that blog post that you kind of promised us you're going to write.
Yeah, I think I've committed myself to it. I've been dragging my heels on it, but now this is going to help me. It's going to help me get it done.
Great. So thank you so much for your time today. Again, nice chatting to you. And hope to see you soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Okay, bye-bye. So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.